Yeah. Hi, Corey.
Hi.
Thanks for coming.
I'm in your radio station killing your dudes.
Everyone's dead?
No. That means we're the last boss. This is kind of a terrible situation. I'm very sorry that the game turned out so poorly. Welcome to Hope. This is not your first Hope.
It is my first Hope. It's the fourth Hope I was scheduled to attend and the first one I made. Multiple earth-shattering storms that grounded all aircraft over the city I was traveling through, and then the one time it turned out to be opposite my birthday weekend, and my wife told me I couldn't go because she had plans.
Oh, yeah. You don't get to go anywhere for your birthday.
Well, we ended up going somewhere else and having a really nice time. It's not exactly a romantic getaway.
Yeah, okay, I guess.
That is
a
fair point.
I think there have been a few relationships founded here, though.
Well, you know what? Like, she speaks at, Tokyo Game Show and GDC, and I don't go to that and, follow her around like a bad smell and say, let's leave this place and go somewhere I'm more interested in. And she doesn't do the same for me, and that's the secret of a beautiful relationship.
For sure. Yeah. There's many, if not most, if not everyone that I know, I would not drag them here.
No.
Hope is a unique place. I have someone here with me this time who's it is their first time, and they were familiar with other cons, and I was trying to explain to them how different Hope is and how it's definitely its own thing. It has its own vibe, and there's a lot of stuff here that you cannot find anywhere else, for better or for worse. Like this radio booth that we...
The sights, the smells, the sounds.
Yeah, especially the smells.
The smells. Actually, there are some pretty interesting smells at DEF CON.
It's true. And every con has its own smells, I think.
It's true.
All right, cool. So what we like to do here is not so much make you reiterate everything you just did in your keynote talk.
Because I haven't done it yet.
He hasn't done it yet.
Oh, okay.
He's on the floor.
You'd need a time machine to make me reiterate everything I just said in my keynote talk.
You didn't tell him about the time machine.
I mean,
there was the whole NDA, and did you fill out all the paperwork? Did you read what you signed?
By appearing on Radio Statler, you agree to let you come over to my house and wear my underwear and make long distance calls and eat the food in my fridge and punch my grandmother, that one?
And agreed to not prosecute for past inferences of these things that have already occurred.
Right. And also to fork as many instances as you need and allow you to interrogate them at your own will. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We're good.
Good. I guess we could talk, if you want to give us a preview of your keynote, just a synopsis.
Sure. I won't
make you blow your whole load on Radio Statler.
So to speak.
Oh, and yeah, so to speak as well.
Right. Let me see. How do I sum it up?
You don't have a talk, do you?
No. It's a new talk, right? So I wrote something new I'm doing three talks on this trip. I just came from MIT's Forbidden Research thing. And I'm going to an IEEE thing in New Orleans next week. And so it's a new thing that I'm talking about. And I'm trying to relate the situation we're in now to denialism and historic forms of denialism. Like, there was a century when no one was sure if tobacco caused cancer. Except if you asked any doctor who wasn't paid by the tobacco industry, they were totally sure whether tobacco caused cancer. It's just that there was this manufactured dissent about whether tobacco caused cancer. Some people paid a lot of money out of their own self-interest. And I want to distinguish different kinds of controversy. You know, there's legitimate controversy about, how different ciphers work, which ones are best, whether quantum crypto is, a game changer, whatever. And then there's this totally non-controversial element, which is can we build backdoors in crypto that only good guys can go through? And that's not controversial at all, except in some circles where it's totally controversial, because the experts there are not saying things they believe, they're saying things they're being paid to say. And I think that we went through a lot of very harmful forms of denial in our recent history. Tobacco denial, climate denial, vaccine denial. And now we're in this realm of Turing completeness denial, right? Which has these elements maybe we could just collect tons of private information on people and it'll never leak or do anything bad. That's not a controversial proposition among people who understand the potential harms of privacy breaches.
Right.
They understand that that's just anything you collect will probably leak and anything you retain will definitely leak. And, the best way not to breach is not to collect and not to retain. And yet, among certain circles, there are people who I think are insincere in their belief that you can collect harmlessly, or that you can build crypto backdoors harmlessly, or that you can put DRM in systems design them to disobey their owners, and then make it a crime to tell people about how that works so that they can't reconfigure it, and that that won't have any harm, or those harms can be contained.
Right.
And I think that we hit a moment in each of these fights, if you look historically at cancer and climate and so on, where you hit peak indifference, where the number of people who care about this stuff ceases to go, it only goes up, right? Because it's so manifestly obvious that tobacco causes cancer, that privacy breaches are bad news, that climate change is occurring.
Sure. And you're saying like it's just being written off as, well, there's nothing we can do at that point?
That's the thing we have to avoid, right? Like, yeah. Denialism begets nihilism, right? Like, we get to this point where the peak indifference, if activists aren't poised to seize that moment and say, now that you care about this, there are things we can do. It's not too late. This wasn't like an emergent phenomenon of a legitimate technical disagreement. This was like named people whose addresses I can give you, who decided specifically and with depraved indifference for your welfare to manufacture the controversy that took us where we are now. Those people made this happen. We can stop it from going any further. It's not too late, and we can make those people pay. And if we can seize the peak indifference moment, we can avoid nihilism. We can, like, privacy nihilism is a huge problem, right? Like, people are like, oh, it's too late. I've already made so many disclosures. I might as well, like, stay on Facebook and get invited to some good parties on the way to the infopocalypse. We need to tell those people that Mark Zuckerberg spent $100 million buying the four houses on either side of his in Silicon Valley, because while he was telling you that privacy was dead, he believed that his privacy wasn't. Right, and that he deliberately, with malice aforethought, decided to set up the circumstances that would destroy your life while protecting his. We need to affect that change. And so we have this moment now where our job as privacy advocates is changing from convincing people to care about privacy to convincing the people who care about it and who will arrive on our doorstop with monotonic regularity every couple of weeks, having had their lives destroyed by privacy breaches, that they can do something about it. That's what the talk is going to be about today.
Excellent. And that is absolutely critical. You're totally right, because we have just become completely indifferent to the concept of privacy. We just accept that, well, everybody, or at least if you want to say the government or whatever your overarching entity of choice is, I say, well, they already know everything about me. What are we going to do?
See, I wouldn't even argue that that's indifference. I would argue that that's nihilism. Like, we had indifference before,
yes,
right?
Yeah,
like,
you're correct.
Who cares if stuff gets collected? It's probably not being correlated. And if it is, nothing bad could happen. Now we're like, oh, it's too late. All the bad things are foreordained. I might as well just sort of relax and enjoy the end of the world, right?
Right.
That nihilism is the thing that we have to avert.
Okay. And are you going to be presenting suggestions for how to avert that?
So, I mean, I think that, like, so here's the thing, right? I'm not a real computer scientist. I was a software developer. I wasn't a very good one. You know, there are people who are much better at it than me. And so I don't want to make prescriptions about how to make good code. My prescriptions are all about how to make sure that the bad code doesn't cause harm. Because I think you don't have to be a software developer to understand that if there are structural impediments to improving code, that it will stop code from being improved. So I propose these two ironclad laws for everything we do going forward, or in the future. I hate the term going forward. It's so stupid. And the future. I propose two ironclad
because
laws.
Because the future is not necessarily us moving forward.
Yeah, and like, we don't move. Time is not space-like. Right? Like,
sure. Well, right, you know, yeah.
It's time is time-like. We don't move forward in time. We progress through time. Anyway, in the future, I think we can have two touchstones that we can refer to all of our policy prescriptions, all of our technological initiatives, and all of our movements that we can use to assess their likelihood to produce graceful failure modes. The first one is that computers should not be designed to disobey their owners, and wherever a computer receives conflicting owner orders from its owner and from a remote party, the owner should always win. And this should be an ironclad law of our technology design. And the second one is that true facts about the suitability, security, and defects in systems that people rely upon should always be lawful to disclose under all circumstances without limitation.
And what do you think is is getting in the way of at least the latter of those two being a cultural thing that we just operate under?
Well, I think that, like, you know, Larry Lessig, he divides these four forces that affect us, right? Markets, code, laws, and norms.
Yes.
And I think that we have these laws, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201, that make it a crime, potential crime, to come forward with these disclosures. And as a consequence, the normative discussion about whether it's legitimate has lagged, because people who have disclosures to make have been silenced by legal threats. And so the evidence of whether or not it's better to make those disclosures has been hobbled, because those we don't have like a robust intellectual marketplace in which people make those disclosures and we get to see whether it's preferable to know whether or not your car has faulty brakes, or to proceed in ignorance and hope that the manufacturer fixes it before it becomes a problem for you. We only have controversial disclosures. We don't have the non-controversial, routinized disclosure of those vulnerabilities. And so we don't have, on the one hand...
I would argue that those are all... that's controversial as well.
Well, no, that's what I mean, right? Like, in software, like, there isn't a thing where people just, without threat of legal... without fear of legal retaliation, are able to just come forward and say, this thing that you rely on is busted, right? That those disclosures themselves become, because they're legally fraught, they're always controversial. It's, you know, it's the 10th anniversary. Yesterday was the 10th anniversary of arrests at DEF CON for security disclosures.
Right.
Right? At HOPE, rather. And then we've had them at DEF CON as well. Right? So, like, the fact that people get dragged off stage at security conferences in handcuffs for making disclosures poisons the normative discussion about disclosures, because where there's smoke, there's fire. If people are being arrested for it, there must be something wrong with it. And it also poisons the market.
Yeah, right? I would like to point out that nothing came of that arrest.
No, absolutely, right? But it colors our perception of it.
Right.
Right.
It made an entire a huge room full of 2,000-ish people
flip out.
Yeah, and think that security disclosures will put you in jail.
Yeah.
And this is a room full of people who are well poised to be making security disclosures.
And all the people adjacent to those people who are like half technical, who are trying to figure this stuff out but don't have the like technical depth to really make like a priori, like good a priori reasoned decisions about it, instead rely on heuristics, you know, like rules of thumb. They go, well, you know, if this is happening, there probably is something wrong there, right?
Right.
And so...
They don't just arrest people for no reason.
Yeah. And then you have this market side, right, which is like you would expect there to be... Like in a robust market, you would expect if there were lots of vulns in technology that people relied on, that there would be like subscription services. We will find and patch your ODAs before they can be exploited. That would be a thing that people would do, that would be a business. We don't have that business, right? The only O-Day markets we have are cyber arms dealers, because those guys operate outside the norms, right?
Right?
Yeah. And so, like, are all of the forces that we could align, code, law, norms, and markets, to create a robust culture of disclosure and remediation of technological vulnerabilities and systems that we rely on, those have been short-circuited by these two antiquated laws. Now, here's the cool news, and the one thing I really want to make sure we hit on this talk today is that the ACLU is suing the U.S. government to repeal the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and Electronic Frontier Foundation has just announced a lawsuit to invalidate Section 1201 of the DMCA, right? And so we are taking aim judicially at those two elements of law that are these like deep impediments to disclosure. And there are ways that people who are listening to this can help right now. So first of all, if you're not a member of the ACLU and EFF, you should be. I've never worked for ACLU. I've worked for EFF off and on for 15 years now. They squeeze a dollar until it hollers. I've never seen anyone spend money better to make more change.
That's true.
You can hedge your bets.
For the relatively small amount of income going through EFF, the amount of change that they affect is
punching
insane.
Way above our weight. And I say that, you know, as someone who wasn't with the organization for 10 years, I went off to write stories to entertain you on the long slog between the cradle and the grave, and decided that, you know, making up fairy tales wasn't cutting it, that, like, I have an 8-year-old who is going to be an adult in 10 years, and if I was going to make a world that was fit for her inhabitants, or habitation, I needed to go and do stuff again. So you should be a member. But the other thing is that the W3C, which were, you know, the guardians of the open web, mm-hmm. have, in a moment of desperation, as browsers have become less important and as apps have kind of taken center stage, they've decided that they're going to standardize DRM as part of HTML5. And this is a total disaster. It's a disaster that everything controlled by a browser will have elements that will be a felony to investigate and report security vulnerabilities on. And EFF has proposed that the W3C should require that their members, as a condition of participation, promise never to invoke the DMCA or laws like it against security disclosures. And we have an open letter from security researchers that includes Ron Rivest, it includes Bunny Wang, it includes the Tor team, it includes Ross Anderson, and some of the leading lights of security in the world. And if you're listening to this and you're a security practitioner, email me, Corey@EFF.org, Corey@EFF.org. Do it right now. Tell me what country you're in, because we want to enumerate all the different countries that support this, because the DMCA has been spread all over the world by the U.S. Trade Representative.
Yep.
And tell me if you have an institutional affiliation, and I will put your name on that petition, and we will take it to Tim Berners-Lee and Jeff Jaffe, the CEO of the W3C, and we will make them understand that the entire security community believes that not immunizing researchers from liability for disclosure of something as widely used as browsers is a total technological disaster, and that they have an obligation, if they're going to craft a weapon for the entertainment industry to use and the browser industry to use against security researchers, that they have an obligation to craft a shield.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And really, they should only be crafting shields.
I know they should. And in my ideal world, they would not be doing this at all. But, like, I'll tell you what. If their members object to immunizing security researchers from disclosing true facts about defects in browsers,
intention of protecting people.
Yeah, and I think you can then presume that if their members won't sign up not to prosecute security researchers, that it's because they intend to prosecute security researchers, right? And so this should be raising all kinds of alarm bells for the W3C, that they have members who object to this, because the only reason to object to it is because you intend to use it, or as I would put it, abuse it.
Right.
And so we really need to hear from security researchers all over the world on this. Corey@EFF.org. The other thing I'd like you to invite your listeners to do. So encrypted media extensions is the DRM spec that the W3C is making. We just had the first audit of an EME implementation. An Israeli researcher investigated Chrome's EME implementation and found that it was full of, like, really obvious showstopper bugs. Now, Israel is one of the few industrialized nations in the world that doesn't have a DMCA 1201-like law, and so he was able to come public with it. We want there to be auditing of all of the EME implementations, Mozilla's, Apple's, and Microsoft's. And if you audit these things and you find vulnerabilities, email info@EFF.org, and we will work with you to find secure and safe ways to make those disclosures. Because we also need to raise the point to the entertainment industry that if they're relying on this to protect their interests, that they're living in a fool's paradise.
I feel like there's a ton of evidence of that already.
Oh, there is. But we need to make it specific to this W3C issue.
Yeah, right, sure.
You know, we can, like, right now their line is, well, if you want us to put premium video on the web, you have to be able to protect us. Well, there is a 6-year-old bug where you could, like, flip a single bit and capture clear text out of Chrome's EME implementation. So what they thought they were getting, they weren't getting. It's like the worst of all worlds, right? They don't get what they want. Security researchers are made vulnerable for disclosing defects that can be used not just to, like, take clear text of movies, but also to, you know, capture the browser, capture its sessions, capture clear text from SSL connections, and you know, also invade the browser to cause it to emit instructions to devices that it controls, because the whole point of HTML5 is to replace apps as the major control surface for actuators and sensors, right? For insulin pumps and nuclear reactors. We need there to be a robust culture of disclosure for those things so that we can remediate their defects.
Right. HTML5 is literally becoming the common platform for quite literally everything that we do.
Yeah, the horribly named Internet of Things.
Yeah.
You know, the way that we know that we don't know what the Internet of Things is for is that we're calling it the Internet of Things. It's like horseless carriage or 3D printer.
That's a horrifyingly excellent point.
Yeah.
3D printer. It's true.
Horseless carriage. How are we doing for time?
We have 8 minutes.
Okay.
8 minutes.
I mean, we'll let you do whatever you want.
No, I got to go print my speech. Yeah. It turns out that nobody at Hope keeps a printer on site, and I revised my speech last night, so I got to go find a Staples.
You could turn a printer into a bomb. Like, that's dangerous. We don't want printers here.
I think they just like, they like to keep the cost down so that as many people as possible can attend, right? Which is like a completely awesome thing to do. And also, like, paper is for losers. But paper doesn't crash in the middle of your speech, so... I always.
I was looking for a stack of papers to flip, but we don't have any paper.
Yeah, no. I'll crinkle a wrapper.
Because we're not losers.
Here's a power bar wrapper.
Yeah.
There you go.
Fuck your paper.
Yeah.
Before you go, I do want to ask you one thing. I'm a fan of your nighttime Twitter presence.
Nighttime Twitter presence?
Well, what's nighttime for me?
What time zone are
you? I'm Central.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And so, in the wee hours, so I'm a pen tester, so I work a lot of wee hours.
Right.
In the wee hours, not a lot's going on my Twitter feed. And
right.
And I'll just start seeing Corey, like, posting little bits of,
weird,
like...
brutalist architecture and 1950s
ads. 1950s
ads,
those are some of my favorites. Just weird chunks of Americana you've gained from somewhere. And I'm like, what are you doing that's generating those?
It's like, my what I do is I am like a human manual conduit from Tumblr to Twitter. So there are all these awesome image-centric, brutalist, Soviet kitsch, Americana Tumblr feeds that I've like assembled by figuring out where people have retumbled from, and I literally by hand copy images out of them and re-upload them to Buffer to post to Twitter at half-hour intervals.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're not in my head, like, you were just laying in bed surfing on your phone.
Yeah, no. It's not like IFTTT or anything. Like, I literally am like right-click, save as.
But then you schedule it as
and
well.
And then I schedule it at
so you're not intervals. Even awake.
No.
Like, I'm like, oh, Corey's bored, just surfing.
No, I have an 8-year-old, so I get up at 5 in the morning. I'm in bed by like 8:30, 9 o'clock every night.
Ruined all of the magic.
No, I'm not like Christian Slater and Pump Up the Volume. I'm like Dad and Leave It to Beaver. I live in Burbank, right? It all looks like it is where they shot all the B-roll for Father Knows Best.
Does it like, still look like that?
It totally does.
That's
and
amazing.
It's Makertown, USA, right? Because it's where all the skilled tradespeople from the studios live. So we've got like the Carpenters Union, the Electricians Union, and so on. It's also where all the deep nerds from Lockheed lived. And so like now they're all dying, right? Like
right.
So all those people, like all those houses were built in the 30s and 40s. And the original owners are dying, and the estate sales every week, and it's like, would you like an entire machine shop for $12? Like,
it's out on the front lawn with a tag on it.
And the haunters and the Christmas lawn displays are out of control. It is amazing. We have 3 year-round Halloween stores on our block. Like, it doesn't get any better. I'm living the dream, dude.
That sounds amazing.
I have a hexa-year in my backyard. Like...
That all right, so that added some magic at the way I think of what you're up to back into my head.
Yeah. There you go.
And when I saw that you agreed to do an interview here, like that was the first thing I thought of. I was like, I have to ask him about his weird Twitter presence.
Yeah,
he does.
No. I'm a super boring scheduler.
I do the exact same thing.
What you said, 36 hours you could be dead before anybody.
Oh yeah, right. Every now and then I put out like a thing where I'm like, hey, canary tweet. Most of my tweets are scheduled, just so I may be dead. If you haven't heard from me in 36 hours, please check in.
I did a talk at Moz once, a couple of months ago, and in the middle of my talk, a bunch of scheduled posts fired, and someone in the like back channel for it like posted, busted, using a scheduler, because like there's me on the stage, and there's my tweet. Although, the other day I did an interview with Radio New Zealand, and I was actually tweeting back and forth with people in between the answering questions. So, I do sometimes tweet while doing other stuff.
And the trick is to just make sure nobody ever knows which it is.
That's right.
Just keep them on their toes.
Although, I think, don't you get user agent in Twitter if you actually open up the XML on the tweet? Like, you can see what the user agent was, and whether, like, sent by Buffer for you know,
you can
Ubuntu or whatever.
You can see the user agent, if you want to call it that. You can't see the method, though, whether it was automated or real-time.
Right. But, like, okay, so here's your tip, then. If it's coming from a Twitter client, it's real-time. If it's coming out of Buffer, it's
if it's coming out of anything non-official Twitter client, there's a chance it's scheduled. And that's, there you go. So we totally blew the lid off of that controversy. Yeah. All right. So thank you for submitting your answers in advance in this recording of you. That was very lifelike.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you for auto-scheduling
our
this.
Our time machine journey is complete. We've had our callback to the first part of it. I think that neatly taps it all together, puts a bow on it.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much.
EOF.
EOF. End of file, kids.
Plus, 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 ATH.
That's modem talk.
Deep cut. All right, guys. See ya.
All right, man.
Thanks.